From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made about a month into the pandemic. The Zoom calls were getting old, anxiety was building, and for parents of young children, the energy was running low. A food and culture writer named Alyssa Shalasky sent a text to a group of her closest friends. She asked simply, none of you guys are actually having COVID sex, right? Shalasky wanted to know if her own lack of sexual appetite was unusual. She was relieved when the text started flooding back. Her friends were mostly married or in relationships. One friend said, God, no, never. Another texted, quote, just the minimum amount to keep my marriage healthy. Still another wrote, I tell my husband it's like Fresh Direct. Open for business, yes, but owing to high demand, there are less windows than usual. Shalasky detailed her feelings in a piece for the New York Times titled, Is Sex Dead for Parents? She writes, quote, finding the time and energy for intimacy was hard enough pre-pandemic. Now wanting to be closer to someone feels almost impossible. Having a lover is an essential I cannot afford right now. I love my partner without reservation, and I am extremely attracted to him. I am not even a little bit mad at him. And yet there isn't a paycheck protection program loan big enough to replenish my libido at this moment, end quote. We understand that sex is kind of a third rail, but we don't really believe in third rails on Connections. Our city is home to the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness. Their therapists see struggles and challenges like this all the time. And the ongoing crisis can make everything feel more severe or dire. Well, this hour, we want to talk about what everybody is experiencing in different ways here, in ways that maybe sometimes make you feel isolated or unusual. But there's a lot that people are going through that might find some commonality, whether you're parents, like Alyssa Shalasky, as she wrote for the New York Times, or you're just on the dating scene trying to figure out, maybe a few months ago you weren't really dating much. Now have the rules changed? What are your expectations? What's healthy? What's safe? What should you expect when you're trying to date? There's a lot to talk about. I want to bring in Dr. Pebble Kranz, who is a sexual medicine specialist at the Center for Sexual Wellness. Dr. Kranz, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much, Evan. So delighted to be back.
Nice to have you. Dan Rosen is with us, a psychotherapist and a certified sex therapist at the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness. Dan, welcome back to the program.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Stephanie Dobbin is with us, a relational and group psychotherapist. Stephanie, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And Summer Kogut is a Rochester resident joining us. Hello, Summer.
Hi. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Nice to have all of you. So, Dr. Kranz, I'll start with you because I admit I read that piece in the New York Times and I laughed a little because she's kind of a humor writer, but she's also making a serious point. And I'm wondering how much you are sort of hearing or experiencing about couples who feel like they've hit a wall. There's too much anxiety. There's too much stress. And there's no mojo right now.
Oh, I would love to address that. Thank you. So I think the reality is that in some relationships, they'll be having less sex and having less sex drive. And in some relationships, they'll be having more. There was actually a poll from NBC News that identified that 24% said the coronavirus outbreak had actually positively affected their sex lives, whereas 47% said it had affected them negatively. But people are all different in this regard. I think a sex drive needs sort of just enough anxiety, tension, uncertainty, excitement to get going. But when we have too much anxiety, tension, and uncertainty, we can't get going. We become overwhelmed, flooded, and sex drive goes away. So that is certainly a struggle that a lot of people are finding, that they're with their partner for so much time. There is less privacy. There are a lot of challenges when it comes to the sexual aspect of relationships, as well as challenges to the relationship aspect of relationships right now as well.
So let me ask you just briefly, and I'll kind of go down the list of therapists, and then we're going to talk about dating and what things are like during this unusual time that none of us thought we'd be living through. Dr. Kranz, for couples who do come to you and say, look, this pandemic could go well into the next year or beyond. Mm-hmm. We'd like to feel a little bit of, sort of the coals heating up again. But we feel like we're always in each other's faces. We're spending a lot more time in the same space. It's taken a lot of the mystery and the energy out of it. What do you do about that?
Well, I think there are lots of things to do about that. One is that this time where we're actually together so much, we need to communicate even more about our relationship, about processing things. And I know that Dan and Stephanie will probably have a lot to say about this. I think that we know this about people who have enjoyable sex lives in the long term in their relationships. One, they have an intimate friend in their partner, somebody with whom they can feel honest and vulnerable. And this is a really vulnerable time. So developing that intimate friendship is one aspect. And then I think the other aspect is that we need to prioritize this aspect of our relationship. We need to spend time, perhaps, even though you're spending all this time together, you may need to schedule time to be sexually playful as well. And then, of course, dating is another whole aspect of figuring out how to navigate this, too. But as far as relationship goes, I think it's really about those two elements, sort of investing in your intimate friends and devoting time to making sexual play a part of your experience.
Okay. Dan Rosen, what do you think?
Well, I think that to some extent, the problem we're having now simply accelerates many of us into the future of our lives as they get more complicated. Parents, as they get older, are taking care of aging parents. Children can come back from college. So this is a unique thing in that it's a medical pandemic, but it's also it accentuates some of the normal things that happens in a relationship. Evan, you talked about sort of the lack of the zing or the sense of what Esther Perel talks about, being a distance between your partner, which draws you closer to pick up that sort of erotic.
Yeah, there's no distance at all right now.
That's right. So for people who are stimulated by chasing, by distance, this is particularly hard, and you have to artificially create distance. For people who are stimulated by emotional connection, even though they're talking about very hard things, there can be a build in intimacy. Mm. So I think that, what Pebble mentioned, Peggy Kleinplatz's work, not by name, but The Magnificent Sex is her book, talking about what do the great lovers have? They talk endlessly about their relationship. They stop being neurotic about themselves. They recognize that they're living in the body that they're going to die in, and this is the body that they're going to use to have sex for the rest of their life. They prioritize sex. We have this mystique in America that sex is spontaneous, and people will always say, well, when we first met, it was spontaneous. No, it wasn't spontaneous. You took a shower, you put on perfume, you cleaned up the bedroom, the guy put the toilet seat down and took his underwear off the floor, and then it was spontaneous.
Planned spontaneity, Dan.
That's right. And we have to do this. And then there's the children factor. So the last thing I researched before this was sort of the idea, because what I keep hearing is that people are anxious about having sex because their kids are going to hear. Well, as far as I know, there's no research that suggests that if your kids hear you having sex, that that's a problem for them, that it's psychologically damaging. It is. Now, it's sex abuse if you're trying to flaunt that in some way, but that children many times have busted in a door that was closed, or the door wasn't closed, or they thought the kid was asleep. And so this might have to be negotiated, but that might enhance the relationship anyway. Negotiating boundaries, negotiating privacy are things that we can leverage this crisis to have important conversations that are going to be healthy for the family as a whole over time.
All right, Stephanie Dobbin, what do you think?
I really like what Dan and Pebble are saying here, and I think that I often get this idea of scheduling sexual activity has come up with couples even before the pandemic, I'll say. This idea that desire can flail over time, or needing to be more mindful when you have young children. I think there's some aspect of this that actually isn't even new. It's just heightened with everything happening. And so sometimes people initially are like, oh, scheduling, like that just takes all the fun out of it. Sometimes I've had lots of conversations around like, is there a way to actually make that fun? And sometimes there is. Sometimes there are more creative ways to say, like, are there ways to look forward to it, build up to it, talk about it? And I know now it can be hard to get that privacy and find childcare and find things to do. But a lot of couples, if there is that mutual idea of like, this is important to us and we want to try to find a way to prioritize it, I agree that just being able to talk more together and allow there to be some more creative conversations is really, really vital. The other part I wanted to mention too is I think in this pandemic, even more so than usual, there can be a way that there's pressure to get all of your needs met through your partner right now, like literally everything. Mm-hmm. And that can also have a killing off effect on sexual desire. So another thing that's been coming up a lot in my world is trying to find ways to also get the distance. Maybe it is having more virtual time with friends. Maybe it is sort of being willing to go out for a walk or be able to talk this through with other people, or not even talk about your relationship at all, but just talk about other stuff other than COVID-19 also when you're socializing, so that there's a break and a little bit more mixed in and a little bit more some extra experiences happening when possible, even if they're not exactly the way we would all love for them to be, but to not lose track of the fact that, you know, it's not going to go well for a long-term relationship to have all the pressure and all of the needs and everything all loaded up right in that relationship.
Sure. And before I turn to dating and bring in Summer and the full panel on dating, just real briefly, Dr. Kranz, you know, as much as, again, we can kind of riff off that article in the Times and couples can joke with their friends that, well, nobody's having it, and, you know, and whatever. There's mm-hmm. also some very serious questions about the strain that this pandemic can put on all kinds of relationships, not the least of which are marriages or long-term committed relationships. Is there any evidence right now that we are seeing an increase in marital split or relationship split more than the average?
So I'm not aware of any data about that. But it does, this situation does bring up another area that can create conflict for couples. We find that people often have these unspoken guidelines in their minds about things that are hard to talk about. Ironically, these things that are hard to talk about and go unspoken are often the areas that are deeply important to us. How to parent, how to spend or save money, how often to have sex, what kind of sex to have. And this crisis has really made it clear that there's another conversation that couples haven't had, which is perhaps how to manage health risks. And that's something that I've seen with a lot of people who I've talked to, where one member of the relationship has a different level of concern about this health risk that we're facing with regard to coronavirus, and another has a different perspective. And I actually have a personal story with regard to this, because this was, I felt like I was a person who in my relationship, and I am married to one of our other panelists, Dan Rosen, I thought that I was pretty clear that we had really addressed a lot of these discrepancies that are in a relationship. And when this pandemic began, as a physician, I knew that I would be exposed to some risk. In fact, it was really important to me, particularly to be involved specifically in the care of people with COVID. And so I knew I was going to have some risk. And early in the pandemic, it seemed sort of clear to me that given how Dan and I are as a couple, how much we process and we talk, we'd kind of be going down together if we went down. And it became clear that Dan, with three kids, with older parents, with his own feelings about his health, that he really did not want to get sick with this illness. And we really had to do a lot of collaborating and talking to come up with something that worked for both of us regarding the management of this new risk. Mm-hmm. And that has fundamentally been a really positive thing. But it made clear to me that these unspoken guidelines, these ideas we have in our head of, that this is the way that I think about something, and therefore it must be that my partner thinks this way as well. We really need to look at those areas. We really need to think about that. So I do think that, as Dan said earlier too, it does bring to the front a lot of issues that can be stressing to a relationship. It's also an opportunity to work through those issues as well.
Okay. Dan, you feel like you're in a pretty good pandemic groove right now with just kind of being in an understanding and frankly managing risk to yourself?
I do. But I moved out for a couple of weeks. I was very afraid, and I think that that's happening in families. And then when I mediated that, I came back. And they were very hard conversations, got to some very deep primal feelings that I almost didn't know that I had. And intimate conversations aren't always pleasant, but it was helpful, and now we're in an even better place.
Well, and so let's turn our attention now for people who, you know, might be trying to navigate dating, what life is like. And Summer Kogut, can I just ask you to describe what life has been like for you in perhaps in that regard?
Yeah, so I'm currently living with my partner. At first, we weren't living together, and that was difficult because so they had their own apartment, I had my own apartment, and our little story here is that our intimacy level was like, we didn't even know, you know, if like hand holding was okay.
Can I ask when you started dating?
At that point it was almost a year.
Oh, okay.
Prior to the pandemic. So, you know, if we're all supposed to be wearing masks, because, you know, our saliva can carry, potentially carry these illnesses. Can I kiss my partner? You know, and then at that point, the test wasn't accessible like it is right now.
Sure.
So it was very scary, more so at first than it is, you know, more now that, so it was, I'd say a little rockier at first. Now we're living together. We're seeing each other every day. We've limited the amount of people that we're seeing. Mm-hmm. I had a roommate at the time, so, you know, that limits the amount of people. A different roommate, I'm sorry. And, I mean, I've met with friends. I've talked with friends, and their dating experiences have all been different. Some have heightened sex drive, some have lower, and it's all very different.
Let me read, Summer, let me read an email I got from a listener named Nicole, and I want to get your thoughts on this when you think about, you know, again, you're single and dating friends. Nicole says, a few months ago, dating basically stopped when the pandemic hit. Only the sketchiest people were proudly dating then, but things really flipped this summer, and now you can find a date, you can find anything on the apps. It's a little much for me. That's from Nicole, but she says things really flipped. Did your single friends find that summer?
Some of them did. I mean, I think it's all a personal preference. Like, if you wanted to stop because you were... I think a lot of it was that people were scared. No one knew. There wasn't a lot of information out. No one had anything to really go off of. So if you were still kind of dating and meeting up with people without having the information about health and how the virus spreads, then yeah, maybe you find that creepy. Who knows? But my friends, I know one in particular, she was talking to people via text message and I believe video, but she wasn't necessarily meeting people in person at the time. And then other people, yeah, some people did completely stop.
Yeah. So let me ask the therapist, Stephanie Dobbin, has Nicole's email rung true to some of the experience you've observed with the dating scene?
Absolutely. I think it seems like the dating scene has sort of evolved the way the quarantine has evolved. So, you know, early there was nothing going on, and not nothing, but as she put, you know, maybe only the bravest, I'll say, or the most reckless, I don't know. People were meeting up. So I think for a while there was not a whole lot going on in person. And as the state has opened up, as the area has opened up some, and frankly, as this whole thing has dragged on and people are becoming single, people want to connect and don't necessarily want to be all on their own, I think there's been more openness to meeting up, talking. What I'm seeing is that it really is pushing earlier conversations about things that typically wouldn't happen until a relationship had been going for longer. So when you think about needing to talk about what are you up to, what are you doing, are you seeing other people, who do you have contact with, do you want to become physical, you know, things that I think often evolve possibly slower or possibly with less discussion now are, at least for people that are really trying to prioritize their safety and want to have these conversations, it's coming up sooner. Can you imagine, like, somebody that you maybe start talking to, texting, maybe have a video chat with, now if you want to meet with them in person, it's really negotiating, like, are we going to wear masks, where are we going to go, and then in moving into more physical territory, you know, these are, in normal times, quote unquote, we wouldn't be having these conversations probably quite so early. And then even down to the exclusivity question of, you know, who are you? Are you with mm-hmm. other people? And what does that look like? I think in some ways it can feel awkward and stilted and unusual. And at the same time, it is setting the stage for a lot better communication about a variety of things. I think the parallel between a physical medical health conversation and a sexual health conversation is, you know, there's a lot of parallels there.
No, that's interesting, Stephanie, because,
absolutely.
You know, my friends in Europe think that Americans are awful at talking about sex. And so Stephanie, when it becomes like a matter of like potential survival or protecting, you know, your family members, particularly your vulnerable family members, you know, if you're going to date, you have to communicate in a different way that's much more overt. And maybe it feels clumsy for people who don't typically communicate that way. But do you think that there is something beneficial about being as direct as saying, okay, yeah, we can go out. What are your expectations? Are you dating other people? Have you had sex in the last month? Are you, you know, all of these things that you would probably never or wouldn't typically say. Is there something that is beneficial about being that direct?
I think so, because honestly, I think these are things a lot of people worry about and consider and stress about and fret about, and try to pick the right timing, or they like don't know if it's okay to find out if they're dating other people, you know, and it can, I don't necessarily know that that's always, that it's good to be holding on to all of that. I kind of, there's something I like about the way that it's now a lot less stigmatized or a lot more expected. Like, yeah, of course we're going to have a conversation about, even it starts with like, are we going to wear a mask when we go out, or when we're going to go walking, or do you feel comfortable eating in a restaurant right now, or do you not want to do that? Like, I just think this idea of getting consent, like, you know, it's kind of promoting getting consent, having conversations that then can translate well, I think, into other conversations about sex and other, and really any, at any stage of a relationship. Because if you can't have the conversation about a mask, or you're going to offend somebody about whether they've come in contact with somebody with COVID, I think for a lot of people right now, they're like, never mind, I don't really want to invest in you right now.
Yeah.
And it's a good way to, you know, weed out somebody that's not going to want to have conversations with you that are really important.
Sure. And one more question for you, and I'll turn to your colleagues on this. I'm just going to relate sort of a frustration that's been aired to me by single friends who are women. And this is maybe a stereotype, but maybe there's a grain of truth. The stereotype being that when there's, you know, heterosexual dating, that a guy is, you know, more often than not willing and even interested in a first date leading to sex, whereas the woman might not be as interested. She might be interested in getting to know somebody, building a relationship. Not always, and I really understand that that's a big generalization, and there's all kinds of diverse approaches, et cetera. But I've heard some frustration from women that, well, everyone on the dating app, that's where they're at on the first date. If you're in that category of having that frustration, does this now give you the green light to be as direct and say, so if the first date goes well, what are your intentions? Can you be that direct?
100%, I think you can. And I think you always...
We always could do that.
Been, always could have been, theoretically, but there is a lot of pressure, I think,
yeah.
or prior, right, to, like, appear a certain way or, like, and I just think this has really allowed people to get down to, like, the real important questions and just not waste a lot of time. I like that. I mean, something like that could still be negotiated, but I think time around having sex is always a negotiation. There's just a way that what I see it as more, I mean, the sex thing, of course, there's I don't know, maybe more license now to kind of just get that out in the open. Like, hey, I'm not going to be willing to do that until we find out if this is worth investing in physically, sexually, that you becoming sort of in my bubble, so to speak. It like offers that framework around it. But I think a lot of it, too, is back to these other, like, prior things, like even needing to negotiate more closely where and how we're going to connect, where we're going to be, what we're going to do. It just sets a good precedent for setting boundaries in general. And I think it leads more naturally into other conversations that may have to do with sexual activity as well.
All right, Dr. Kranz, are my European friends right, or do we struggle to be direct about sex?
We do, and I just have to say first, amen to everything that Stephanie just said. We do have a hard time talking about it, and I think that this is a real opportunity, these conversations about COVID and how we're going to interact with this virus in our midst is a really great opportunity to make talking about other aspects of sex less stigmatized. It might be easier once you've asked your questions about COVID, it might be easier to ask. So while we're at it, what's your status with HIV, syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, trichomonas, herpes, etc. That is a great thing to take advantage of here. Having these conversations more openly, sooner, and then the other thing that Stephanie said that I also love is this idea of consent as an ongoing important dialogue. It's not just a moment. It's this ongoing important dialogue. And this is something actually that people in the kink community really really know well and that we can learn a lot from. This idea that consent is this ongoing dialogue, that the consent conversation can be sexy and fun and part of the excitement, and that when we talk about kinds of sex, we need to talk about not only what it means for us in terms of health risk and what we're going to do, what we want to do in terms of what it means for health risk, but what it means to us, what this kind of sex means to us, and what's the mood we want to go for, and what's our intent with this? What are our limits? How do we understand each other's communication? How are we going to know when this is going a direction we don't want it to go, or how do we know when it's going a direction that we do want it to go? And how are we going to handle problems as they arise? So these are all, that's all a part of the consent conversation. And this is this opportunity we have when we're really having these conversations up front, before holding hands, before the first kiss, before meeting face to face, to really think about having this conversation in a way that's fun and sexy and flirtatious.
Okay. Dan, you want to add to that?
I do. I'm glad. I appreciate everything everyone said. So, Evan, I think that there's sort of a split. We can't generalize about all Americans, obviously, but the split that I want to point out is the cosmopolitan Europeans, not the people who are much more fundamentally conservative, but yes, they're having more conversations about sex than we are. So I think the split in America is that the polyamorous people and the kinky people and the gender diverse communities and gays and lesbians are having many more conversations about sex, about the kind of risk they want, the kind of sex they want, how to do the sex, who they're going to do it with, where are we going to do it, why are we going to do it, what is it going to mean to you if we have a particular kind of sex. And that the phrase heteronormative, tending to refer to the sort of general idea that we've been having baked into our conversation, that it's heterosexual people who are going to go monogamously try to date one person and see if they can form a long-term relationship, that cohort of people has a lot to learn about how to talk about sex.
Okay. okay, I'm listening. And why don't we do this?
It's maybe a lot.
It's okay, though, because we don't believe in third rails on connections. We can talk about anything, and we should, because this is life, and this is relationships, and a lot of relationships have been strained by this pandemic, and we're talking about healthy ways to approach a lot of different aspects of that with our guests. Drs. Pebble Krantz and Dan Rosen is with us, a psychotherapist. They're with the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness. Stephanie Dobbin is a relational and group psychotherapist. Summer Kogut is a Rochester resident sharing their experience. And after our only break, I want to see what they think about some of the policy planning that other countries have offered their citizens when it comes to understanding what to do during this pandemic. And then, you know, maybe how we all emerge from this a little bit stronger. I'll read some of your feedback as well on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections. This summer for college graduates and for people entering the job market was supposed to be one of launching careers. Instead, it's been one of contraction economically, and now, for those who are looking for jobs, some big decisions to make. Are the careers still viable? What happens to income that is being cut across the board? What about people who are living at home? We'll talk about it Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Teresa writes to say, yay for scheduling sex. Evan, we are happily married for 30 years, and scheduling sex works great for us. I highly recommend it. When our last kid went off to college, I said, there's nothing like privacy to improve your sex life. And boy, is that true. I feel for the couples out there cooped up without any privacy. That is from Teresa. And so maybe there's an endorsement of the scheduling aspect, which seems a little regimented for some, or maybe if you're doubtful, but there you go. Teresa says yes to that. Now, when the pandemic was in early days, Holland's national health leadership made a recommendation for single people who wanted to keep dating and you know, didn't want to sort of shut that part of their lives down. They recommended finding a sex partner, just one exclusive sex partner throughout the pandemic, so you could be aware of who you're with, who they're seeing, you know, in terms of the, perhaps work or interaction. You could limit exposure, but you could still have that aspect of it. I want to ask all of you, I'll start with Dr. Kranz, does that make sense to you? I mean, I can't imagine this country's, you know, sort of health leadership at the national level saying something like Holland's leadership said, but did that make sense to you?
It does make some sense. Actually, there have been some great guidelines put out by New York City's Department of Health about how to have safer sex during COVID, and really thinking about this as addressing gradations of risk, that you are your safest sex partner always. It's true for people in relationships as well as those who are dating. And then household contacts are your safest sex partner, and then have as few sex partners as possible, and pick ones that you really trust. So this is New York City's Department of Health saying this. In fact, there are recommendations about being creative about how you are using barriers in this New York City recommendation. That is actually, we're in a list of people from all over the world who have done the same training that I have through the Multidisciplinary Joint Committee on Sexual Medicine in Europe. They have people from all over the globe. And this New York City guideline at first and in its subsequent revision in June was being circulated all over the place as, now this is a realistic guideline for how to safely manage both balancing one's personal and public health with the fact of the matter that people will have sex. And so Canada also has on a governmental website also recommended some very creative methods for having safer sex during COVID. I can't see the CDC putting this out, but New York City leads the way in so many ways. It's a great guideline. I recommend everybody to look at it. This one of the other things that I really love from it is this idea of the questions to ask about COVID before you hook up, before you decide to have sex with somebody new. Do they have symptoms? Have they had symptoms in the last 14 days? Have they been exposed to anyone with a positive COVID test? Have they been diagnosed with COVID, or are they waiting for a test result? So those sort of those same questions that you're getting asked before you go to a doctor's office now, or before you go into a lot of other places, like hair salons and stuff like that. Those are important questions to ask. And there really are some ways to minimize risk as well. And ways to responsibly think about public health, after you've had a hookup or another encounter with somebody who isn't a household contact sex partner. Mm-hmm. You know, there are ways to address safer sex with COVID in the reality of the fact that people will have sex.
Okay. Stephanie Dobbin, what do you think?
I think I really like the idea of acknowledging that single people are going to want to have sex. And I know early on, there was just a ton of focus of just kind of stay away. And it was the safest, and it still is the safest. But I think we need to acknowledge that people are, you know, especially if this drags on, as it seems like it will for quite some time, trying to help people find the safest way. I was reading a bit, Dan mentioned Esther Perel earlier, and she had something that I came across about how this pandemic for single people has, I think she called it creating turbo relationships, or like really high speeding, like putting things on the fast track in a way that is not necessarily bad, but just to be mindful of. If you're, and so that came to mind when you talked about the recommendation out of the recommendation to find a single sex partner, that I think negotiating the terms of that would still be really important. I know in this article I came across, there had been, she had come across some anecdotal stories of people who had decided to cohabitate right away or just like quarantine together, quote unquote, and really move their relationship into a space that you wouldn't normally see happening so quickly necessarily. So it, I guess in my mind, it just brings up that idea again of communication, talking, making sure that whatever the arrangement is, there's been lots of discussion about why we're doing this. Are we doing this because, you know, what are the reasons? And I think doing something for health safety reasons or financial reasons, there can be lots of reasons why we decide to live with somebody or be exclusive sexually with somebody. As long as there's good talking about it, I think it's a good thing.
Well, Summer Kogut, you've been living with your partner for a little while now. Do you feel that your relationship has been stronger as a result of this? And do you feel like you had the kind of communication that you needed to make these decisions during a pandemic?
Yeah, we've had a lot of communication. We are both, we both experienced a lot of stress during this time. And we're both Black, and a lot of it had to do with the killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. So The communication and the stress that happened definitely centered around those things. So what we did was just open communication about what we needed from each other and from the people around us, and we asked for, we put out our demands from the people around us, what we need from them, what we need for each other, and we actually took like a mini vacation, and what that meant for us was that we needed somewhere in seclusion, right? We can't be around people. We took to Airbnb, and it had to be, you know, the whole house, and it had to, in the ad, we had to find a host that kind of took the responsibility of the safety of their guests, right? So That was important to us, and that was really, really important. That kind of rejuvenated our minds and our bodies and prepared us to come back into the house, and that was like a total disconnect. So we put our phones away, and it was really uplifting for, you know, the relationship, for our community, because when we came back, we were ready to get back into like activism and everything. So, I mean, we've had some hard times and really good communication though, to get through it. And,
you endorse the Airbnb getaway if you can.
Yeah, but it's really important to make sure that you're the only people in the apartment or the house or the, you know, wherever it is, The host makes sure that, you know, they're definitely upkeeping the place.
Yeah, and the good news is, as Summer found, you can find that. That's out there.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of people are trying to take advantage of it. Let me grab a phone call. Keith in Shortsville is on the line. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, how you doing?
Good.
A couple comments. Over the last 2 years, I've spent about 5 weeks in Europe in various cities, and they treat sex education totally different. I know it starts in kindergarten. In the United States, it officially starts when you get on the school bus, because I remember everything I learned on the school bus when I became an adult wasn't true, because when I went to high school, you didn't have sex ed. Everything was trial and error. But I think the major problem in this country is the religion influence. And I remember when Bill Clinton's Surgeon General encouraged teens to masturbate. She was vilified for that. She eventually resigned. I remember when Ed Meese was the Attorney General, and he was offended by standing in front of a statue of justice holding the scales, and she had one breast exposed and it had to be covered up. You walk around Europe, and that's all you ever see are naked statues, and it's no big deal. But in this country, it's just appalling. People can't deal with it. And I think we pay the price for more unplanned pregnancies, teen mothers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Keith, thank you for the phone call. Dr. Kranz, is his condemnation of religion too broad sweeping for you, or is there something there in your eyes?
Well, I think that spirituality, I have to apologize. We just had somebody banging on our door,
oh.
And so I got a little distracted. So maybe somebody else.
Yeah, I'm going to kick it to Stephanie.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. I'm going to kick it to Stephanie, and I'm just going to sort of encapsulate a little. So Keith's essentially saying that sort of a puritanical thread, a thread of religious approach to sex kept sex out of textbooks or the classroom or just talking about it in schools early on. It allowed kids to get the wrong information about sex, you know, from whether the school bus, the playground, et cetera, and that there is just sort of a very limited view of sexual health based in Keith's view on religious hierarchy. And Stephanie, how do you feel about that?
Well, that is quite a huge topic, but I would say that...
It's a whole other hour.
It is. It's a whole other hour. It definitely goes beyond my scope generally. I would say, you know, in my limited experience around different religious traditions, I think, like anything else, there can be certain sects and areas where there's less talking about sex and it's not okay. A lot of this comes down to kind of an individual basis. I think culturally in this country, it's just a huge question. And as for why we struggle to talk more openly about it, you know, I think it's in there. It's in the mix. It's certainly a valid experience many of us have had. I know for myself, I grew up Catholic, so that's the tradition I'm most familiar with. And I know there was, you know, a tremendous amount of guilt and conversation. Now, that didn't exist within my own family of origin. We sort of were able to have different conversations. But, you know, on the whole, I would say there's lots of things that were, quote unquote, off limits or not okay or not seen as okay. So that's kind of where I had the most firsthand experience navigating that balance between sort of what was like the party line as far as the Pope or whatever versus what my family accomplished.
Sure.
And also the school district I happened to go to had a much more open approach to sex education.
Sure. And Summer, from your perspective on schools, are you aware of schools broadening what is taught, what is addressed and discussed, and maybe expanding that? Is it improving in any sense as you see it, Summer?
Not as far as I know. When I was in school, it was taught, I believe, in fifth grade one time, and that's when, like, the presumed boys and the presumed girls were separated, and it was taught one time, and then we didn't really talk about it much after that, just amongst ourselves, and no one really corrected us, or there wasn't a course about it, continuing education at all. Nope.
Well, I want to close the hour with maybe, some ideas for what we can do to strengthen where we go next, because everyone's in a slightly different situation, of course, Dr. Kranz, but what do you want people to be thinking about as we try to prepare to, you know, bring our relationships through a pandemic that is not going to be over anytime soon?
Well, I think the strongest message I'd like to leave people with is to be gentle with one another. And that perhaps we can learn from the Corona coaster that many of us are on in our relationships. We can learn a little bit from the highs, learn a little bit from those moments where our relationships feel stronger and closer because of this, the stress of the pandemic, the stress of what's going on in terms of social justice. Thank you, Summer, for mentioning that. That's huge for a lot of people. And learn, too, that we can work our way through the difficult things. And sometimes we can work our way through those difficult things on our own, and sometimes it's helpful to have an outside view helping us with those difficult relationship moments. I'd like to put a plug that the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness has three ASEX certified sex therapists. We have a certified menopause medicine provider. We have me, a sexual medicine specialist. There are wonderful relationship therapists like Stephanie Dobbin and other wonderful relationship therapists in town. We're at Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness. We have providers available now for both virtual and in-person visits. I want people to feel hope that that this doesn't have to be a impossible time for relationships or for sex.
And we've reached just about the end of the time, but if people want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
You can reach us at www.rochestercenterforsexualwellness.com, and lots of information there about lots of sexual and relationship issues, gender and menopause care as well. Thank you so much for having this conversation. I know that we've gotten some, there's been a lot of hot topics here.
Yeah.
And I appreciate your offering a forum for people to think about this.
It's life, and people don't have to feel ashamed about these very many, many subjects that people may occasionally struggle with. It's part of life. Dr. Kranz.
Amen.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kranz. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you.
Dan Rosen, a psychotherapist with the center. Thank you very much, Dan.
Evan, thank you so much.
You got it. Stephanie Dobbin, a group psychotherapist and relational doctor as well there. Stephanie, thank you for making the time for the program.
Thank you, Evan.
Summer Kogut, good luck to you. Thanks for sharing your perspective.
Thank you for having me.
From the whole team at Connections, Rob Braden is the engineer, Megan Max the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.